crimes, Amy, we're torturing them too. If you listen to what happened to Badr Khan Suri, who's a Georgetown student who was also detained, the torture that he's gone through, the abuse, the sleeping on the floor, the denial of clean underwear, and now Rusmea Aztürk, Ayanna Pressley, congresswoman, told me that when she went to see her, she was denied health care. She suffered severe asthma attacks. She had her hijab removed without consent. I mean, we are Louisiana, that detention center in Louisiana is famous for human rights crimes. So why are people being sent from Vermont and Massachusetts and New York, Mahmoud Khalil, to Louisiana? That in itself is a question we should ask ourselves. We're torturing people again.
So, Mehdi, in that same interview, Ayanna Pressley said to you, this is not about the Trump administration. This is not about weathering the next 4 years. I believe this will dictate the next 100. We have 30 seconds. Your response to that?
I think she's right in many ways. I think we are in that historical period. Now, this is not just about Trump. You look at the global rise of fascism and authoritarianism. You look at what's happening with Narendra Modi in India and Orban in Hungary, Putin in Russia and Ukraine, Middle East autocrats. We are in that place where a democracy, the progress we made over the last 80 years, 100 years, is at stake, very much so.
Can a judge just stop immigrants from being sent to Libya on a U.S. military jet? And over 80 students were just arrested at Columbia. And Rubio said he'd pull international visas of students who were protesting. Your final thoughts in 5 seconds.
Fascism isn't coming, Amy. It's here.
Mehdi Hasan, the editor-in-chief of the media website Zateo, which is celebrating its one-year anniversary this week. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh for another edition of Democracy Now!
You are tuned in to KBOO Portland, 90.7 on your FM dial.
K282BH, Philomer, on 104.3 FM.
And K220HR, Hood River, on 91.9 FM.
And streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
Volunteer-powered community radio.
KBOO.
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 Time on the inside. Got just a few seconds left. Strange people. People born just a little different than you and I. Are you ready?
Come join the Radio Lost and Found Sideshow Wagon as it rolls into your town. Radio Lost and Found is a two-hour media escape of found sounds, forgotten records, outre recordings, and more. Coming to you every second and fourth Thursday from 10 to midnight right here on KBOO.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Executive Committee meets on the second Thursday of the month at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting virtually can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
This is Keeping It Real, and I'm Lisa Loving. Our guest is A.J. McCrary of the Equitable Giving Circle. They provide radical care for the Black community in Portland. AJ, what is the Equitable Giving Circle?
Yeah, thanks for having me on the show. The Equitable Giving Circle is a direct service organization in Portland, Oregon. We are founded and led by Black women who are all from Portland, Oregon, our entire leadership team. We are all born and raised here. We do food access work, housing initiatives, and community wellness work. And we have a robust or deep bench of programming that we do to support the community.
How did you start?
We started initially in 2019. I had participated in another giving circle, was inspired by the collective giving, but that wasn't the right space for me. An elder had introduced Lillianne Green and myself, my co-founder, and like, y'all can should know each other. You would get into some really great trouble together. Be friends. And Lillianne was like, oh, okay. And I was like, oh yeah, let's be best friends. Yes. I pitched this idea of creating a giving circle to her and some other women within the community. They were like, hey, that actually is a cool idea. Let's explore it. Let's get moving with it. So we started with that. Initially, we were going to support Black and brown women and femmes in the biz community and really kind of just hyper focus on being more of just like this support within the business space. But then the COVID happened. And I had been doing some work, my consulting work with farmers, really inspired by that group. One of my favorite Black icons in Black history is Dr. Booker T. Watley, who is the Black farmer that coined CSA, or who was supporting agriculture. COVID was brewing. We had this group of women that were regularly talking and trying to figure out how we could be a collective support in the community. I pitched, hey, let's buy through CSAs from Black and brown farmers. Let's give them away to Black and brown community members. Everybody loved the idea. We launched a fundraiser, raised $35,000 that first week. Then I was like, let's double down. And we did, and things just kind of spiraled since then. So that's how we got started. And we've had robust programming, like direct boots on the ground since June of 2020.
All right. Full disclosure, I participated in the Equitable Giving Circle during the COVID lockdown. I grew dozens of little tiny baby houseplant starts on my patio and dropped them off at a cafe near the Lloyd Center. And it was not about me, but it was so good for me, from my perspective, to just watch these little green guys grow and thrive and then send them off to new families. It made me feel like a puppy mama or something like that. Sometimes people wonder who can participate, and I just wanted to bring that out. So can you list out all your programs right here so that we can get them on the table and start looking at them?
Yeah, and I love that you participated in Plant Jam and sharing. That's such a good practice in our collective stretching and just muscle of sharing is our plant program, where we collect and give out plants. Yeah, so programming the EGP does. It's a lot. It always feels like a pop quiz. I will try to be as concise about it all. Our CSA, Community Supported Agriculture Program, we have our home delivery that delivers Tuesday through Friday to about 225 households. And then every Thursday, this is our second food access programming. We have our free market, and we see right now it's like 175, 180 households a week. So we see about 100 or 400 families that we support weekly. That number has the highest a little over 500. At the lowest, I think it was 350. We would like to grow and be a steady like 800. We need more dollars for that. But that's our food programming. That's our most known program that we have. And it's been really consistent the last almost 5 years. And then we have a housing program that right now is just kind of on ice. We're looking for housing dollars. We put $200,000 of the community in 3 month rent and mortgage relief grant a couple years ago. And the idea around that is support going upstream and making sure that we keep people housed. It's just a lot easier and better for this whole conversation around housing to make sure that we're keeping people housed as well as helping people in crisis. That's a program that we would love to be realizing monthly to be able to support people in that way. We're also, right now I'm in conversation in a couple of spaces to try to pilot a free housing model where we support some Black mothers who can live for 3 to 5 years not paying rent or very low cost. We're still exploring exactly what that looks like just within the container of our current laws, because there's some weird housing laws. But the goal would be to help them with having very low cost rent that they in a nice place, not something that's raggedy. Because that's important to us, to live and not be paying a huge exorbitant rent, $1,500, $2,500 is a lot. You can't save for a down payment. It's really hard to move through that process. So this would be a way for us to help push folks towards home ownership. And we really believe in betting on investing in Black women, because we're really one of the best demographics in terms of investing. And we do what we say we're going to do. So that's our housing program, and we're definitely looking for dollars and looking for, you know, partnerships and opportunity there. And then our community wellness programming, which is a lot. We have our plant jam, which is a program we've had since that first summer that we started, where we're collecting and giving out plants. We've also started to give out bouquets of flowers, fresh flowers, and have done some fun little projects within that with sharing flowers. We have a regular flower donation that we're always trying to give people their flowers in real time. That's also evolved into, last year, I piloted an elder garden project. And so we worked with two elder gardens, one in Southwest Portland, that's going to be a 29-year-old garden this year. And the other one in North Portland, that is a 22-year, this will be its 23rd season-year-old garden. So we'll be working with a third garden as well this year in Irvington Northeast, and that's a 70-year-old garden. These are all Black elders, living history. We're getting people from the community to come and grow, learn in the land, tending the land. We love all of the opportunities to go out to the wilderness, the beach, all of that, to the farm. That's all valuable. We want to uplift that too. We also, as a city girl, we want to uplift tending the land here in the city as well. And so this is another addition to a lot of the beautiful work that is happening around sort of our nod and caretaking of the land. So that's one of the programs. We also have a walking group that happens twice a month at Wilshire Park. We just get together and walk in community. It's really beautiful. We've been working on it. Sometimes the rain is a deterrent for folks, but we're still out there. We're Oregonians. We will not melt. We also have a once-a-month blood pressure group that meets at Alder Commons. And we have a nurse that comes out. There's an opportunity to talk about food, taking our blood pressure. And that's just a really beautiful space that we've been cultivating for the last, I want to say, year and some change under our CSA director, Tamar Green. So that's happening. It's so much. We have this event series, Earth Day, Mother's Day, Juneteenth, Back to School, Holiday Extravaganza. These are robust community events. The first three, Earth Day, Mother's Day, and Juneteenth, are more of a community gathering and celebration, kind of like birthday party vibes. We don't have to do anything. We're just like hanging out, having a good time, building community. There's like themes and activities, but it's really just a gathering, building space. And then our back to school event and our holiday extravaganza are big events, push out resources to the community to support, both with back to school and then end of the year celebrations. And just resources tend to get tight at that time of year. Kids are growing, all that fun stuff. So that we do that, and we're really intentional about all of these products that we give out are really beautiful, high quality, not raggedy, dusty, you know, used up, because we really do believe in our community getting the very best. We have a podcast called The Sharing Culture. It is, we're about to be releasing season two in, I want to say, a week, give or take a couple days. So that, you can find that all over on regular, like, all the places you can find podcasts. And then we have our newest program that we piloted, are really excited about this year, is our Healthy Families, Healthy Birth program. And this is an opportunity for us to support in the space of Black maternal health, which is the core of supporting mothers and families and birthing folks and babies. So we are not a service oriented in terms of like being a doula or anything like that. That's not our lane. This is an opportunity for us to support folks with practical resources. So we're currently supporting 31 families, and they're either currently pregnant or just had a baby or have a really small person in their care. So they're just welcome to human. And we're supporting them with weekly CSA boxes. So fresh produce in season, grown locally, all very beautiful, high quality, as well as some hyper-specific pantry staples, both to the household and then also just considering the dietary needs and extra vitamins that pregnant folks and nursing folks or new mothers, new parent families in general need. This is really thinking about the wraparound services that the whole family needs care and food and nourishment during this time, both pregnancy and, you know, caretaking for a brand new person. And then we're also supporting with practical resources like diapers. We haven't had a formula request that I know of yet, but thinking about that, everybody's been getting a Blooming box modeled off of the baby boxes that they do in Sweden and Norway, with have all kinds of supplies in it. One of my favorite additions is one of our community grandmothers, Grandma Sarah. He has been making baby quilt, though they're also getting a handmade beautiful baby quilt. So that is a program that we're really excited about, just the ways that we can kind of lean in and support. One of the things that our larger community really does need are practical resources. I know that's really hard for us to wrap our brains around sometimes, but folks that are living in, you know, the margin of this financial capitalist landscape that we exist in, folks that are living below the poverty line, these kinds of practical resources really make a difference in moving forward, thriving, and just surviving. But we try to like give a little extra so it feels less survival and people can lean in. Yeah. So I think that is everything. I probably forgot something, but we have a lot of really robust, beautiful programming, a solid volunteer program. So that's also opportunity for people to kind of tap in. We just don't think about our volunteer programming as like programming because they just kind of get involved and they're part of the team.
Right. So if you just tuned in, this is Keeping It Real, and I'm Lisa Loving. Our guest is AJ McCrary of the Equitable Giving Circle. They provide radical care for the Black and Brown community in Portland. And I just want to take a minute to walk back. So you're talking about several hundred households that get food boxes. Each house might have 2, 3, 4 people in it.
Yep.
So how many people, not households, are you impacting with Evavim?
Our estimates and from like our surveys and what we know is roughly 2,000 people. Those are the actual households that we're being delivered to. The reality is most households that we serve, like a lot of them have 4+ people. So we just kind of keep it right around the 4. Many of the homes that we deliver to also share their box, right? So it's a lot of produce, depending on your family size, depending on a lot of details. So we have quite a few people that we know support it. There's an elder, one of my favorite elders, one of my beloved elders, our beloved elders in Northeast Portland. When she gets her box, she will take out the things that she knows that she'll eat the most. And she brings it. She has 2 neighbors that she brings produce to, and sometimes her kids will get produce. So that box feeds truly like a corner in Northeast Portland every single week. So it really, the box and the way our community operates really is about sharing. I know of many households that get a box and they absolutely share their produce. Not just it's an abundance, but we can all have something if I have something. So who knows what is the true larger impact? It has ripples.
I'm in a really small space and I want to windmill my arms and I want to jump around a little bit. Equitable Giving Circle, one of the things that is amazing to me about you, I interview a lot of people. I interview a lot of organizations. You're so professional. You're so well put together. And I'm not just talking about your outfit right now. No, you guys are well put together. And I think that matters a lot when you're hatching these other eggs. It seems like you're looking around and seeing what the need is. And then in an organized and in a way that's got boundaries too. Right?
Yeah.
You're figuring out how you can do that. That's incredible. How do you do that? Come on. How do you do that? Like, what is your struggle? I have to ask you this because a lot of people listening to this show have a big idea and they want to do some community project, but they don't even know where to start. So how you do so much, what is your governing structure like? Do you have you're the executive director. Just talk about that a little. How does your leadership work?
So we have a unilateral leadership style. So we really do check in and talk to each other. It's not like, oh, AJ has the final say or AJ and Lillian have the final say. For example, CSA is under Tamar's leadership. So we look to her, okay, what do we need to do? What shouldn't be happening? Or we really let her take the lead and we trust her in that. I do our marketing and our fundraising. Our team trusts me in that. I lead that. I stay in my lane. Not to say that we are not in constant communication or collaboration, but we really respect each other as leaders. Lillianne does our community wellness work. We really lean into her leadership. And she's like, this is what needs to happen. This is how it goes. We listen to that. We also are in constant communication, even though we are right now very remote. We don't have our own space. We meet as a team every Monday for upwards of 4 hours. Virtually, we do it sometimes in person. We also meet every other Friday as a team. So we're in, not just like we are texting and emailing and having side conversations. We have designated time to like build, converse, problem solve together. And that really does matter in the way that we're able to build. We do spend significant time talking. Also not bothered to be like, hey, can I talk to you real quick? Or hey, can you problem solve? And I think that's a big part of it, is that we have this deep relationship with actually building. When people have an idea, you're not going to get your idea off the ground. Like, I had some big ideas around, like, as we got started, like how we could make this giving circle. And by myself, this idea would still be, you know, just some document on my computer. But when I started talking to other people and they had feedback, they had ideas, they were like, maybe not so much that, but what if this happened, or connecting these dots? That collaboration is what like has bred EGC and has sustained this work. And so anybody who's wanting to build something, I would say, well, who are people that you can collaborate, you can be partners in crime, get in good trouble with? And then also be consistent. Like, that's the thing too, is that this, any kind of work, whether it's a body of work like this, whether it's farming, whether it's a podcast, you're not going to be successful unless you are really consistent. And that means you have to be consistent as an individual and consistent as a team, and be committed to that consistency. I think that's something that we collectively in our modern space, we struggle a bit with commitment and consistency. And those are two behavior patterns that will absolutely transform the way that we function in the world, feel the world, see the world, and then, you know, ultimately build things.
All right. I want to shift gears a little bit.
Yeah.
Community supported agriculture is usually something I associate with white hippies, honestly. I'm putting it out. Okay. And why did you decide to go the direction of CSAs, and how do your CSAs work?
Yeah, so it is really funny that most people's association with CSA is a white, rich, or hippie, or, you know, it's for white people of some kind, right? But it is actually a very black thing. CSA, Community Supported Agriculture, and you're going to get a bit of a history lesson, is coined by Dr. Booker T. Watley, a black farmer out of Tuskegee University. He got his doctorate over out on the East Coast. So he's deep in the agriculture community in the 60s and into the 70s, right? Like, he is making waves. He comes up with this idea of community supported agriculture, where he's going to invite black folks, predominant audience, but also revolutionaries and movement workers in the 70s were very class conscious and very thoughtful to include other groups of people, poor folks, with them in their building. You see that in the Black Panther Party. You see that in with MLK. You see that in a lot of different spaces during that time. So Booker T. Watley was like, all of these rural people that have in the last, you know, 50 years, they've been out here in these rural areas. They've been flocking to city spaces, urban spaces. We now have a labor crisis. And y'all have a food crisis in the cities, because now you're no longer growing a small garden, being able to share in that way. So Dr. Booker T. Watley said, how about you urban folks come back out here for our planting and our harvest, and maybe other different times as well, but hyper-focused on the planting, the beginning of the season, the end of the season for harvest. And in trade for your labor and your time, you can take produce back, can it, preserve it, and then you will have food all through the winter. And we are collaboratively, collectively addressing these two issues, this labor issue around food agriculture, as well as this food security issue that's happening in urban settings. So this was a model that took off and was spread all throughout the country and beyond, and people got really excited about it. And in the 70s and into the 80s, we have elders in our community here that even talked about experiencing this, going out to farms, doing a CSA in this model. I know she didn't ask to be dragged into my storytelling today, but Miss Michelle DePass, who's on our school board, she's a Black elder here. Her family was involved with the Black Panthers. She's a wonderful storyteller, absolutely awesome person to chat with. She knows lots of really fun, juicy, and interesting and deep history. But she talks about and has told me many stories about her family participating in community-supported agriculture in the, from this exact time, this model. So it, this concept traveled all the way out here to the last frontier, the Pacific Northwest, which is a very different small community with all of its problems and issues and wins. So that... that is a Black term. Community-supported agriculture is a very Black, Blackety-Black experience in food spaces, and it absolutely revolutionized the way that we were talking about food access and justice in the 70s. So when, for me as a historian, my degree is in African American history, I absolutely, he's one of my favorite Black icons because his work was so profound and had such reach, and it's just pragmatic, and I really respect that and I like that. And he's just a lesser known icon, and being from Portland and the Pacific Northwest, our relationship with farm to table is much more robust and loud and current. Like, it, I've always known about that here, where in other places that's like a new concept or newer. So when we had an opportunity to start building, okay, how are we going to address the community? Of course, I'm going to start thinking of like revolutionaries, movement workers from our own community. And that's how he enters the chat. And I had been working with some Black and brown farmers around the time. And so I was like, we could bring this back in a whole new way and reclaim it. The really interesting thing about our food work is when I started to like dream this up and talk it into existence with Lillian and our board and our larger community, there were so many folks in the food justice space who were like, you can't do this. This is impossible. And we were like, okay, cool. Yeah, maybe you haven't seen any good movies because like lots of things seem possible. And we just kept on trekking, and here we are 5 years. So this is an ode, a nod to history. It's also for us important to uplift Clara Peoples' work. She is a Black icon. She's the Black woman who brought our public celebration to Juneteenth here in Oregon. She used to feed hundreds of people from her porch. It's rumored that she actually started the Oregon Food Bank. I believe that rumor. She is... an incredible leader and icon, not just in food justice, but just creating space for Black people and liberation work in so many different spaces. And then the Black Panther Party as well is another really big inspiration for our team in terms of our work and how we're thinking about food. Like, so for us, the consistency of weekly, like that is absolutely a nod to the work that the Black Panthers are doing here, not just in Portland, but in Oakland and beyond. Mr. Kent Ford, who is one of the co-founders of our local chapter, is a beloved elder of ours and a mentor of mine. And we really appreciate the work that they, as a collective, laid for us. And so, yeah, how we function and operate and how we understand CSA really comes from within the Black community and understanding. And there's so many people here in Portland that have inspired our work. So, yeah, it's our own interpretation. And so for us, what that looks like is we work and buy from local Black and brown farmers. We pay market rate. We are really trying to uplift that. We're not farmers, but we're trying to uplift and really respect their work and how they show up and they feed us. We've worked with dozens of farmers across the region. Right now, one of our main farmers, Pablo Muniz Farm, they're a mid-sized farm. So in this, we've also learned a lot about farms, from micro farms to small farms to, here's another one, mini farm. Like, there's like levels to farming and, you know, year round. We work with our local farmers. We buy the produce from them. It's important that we're buying it fresh. We're getting it at its heat quality. Most of our boxes, the produce, when it's delivered, is, you know, been out of the ground for less than 48 hours, unless it's something like apple. But even those apples are the freshest. I bought apples at the store the other day, and I was very disappointed. I was like, oh, I'm not used to this. It's really our interpretation is just it looks different, and it's grown and it's evolved. So we receive our produce from our farmers Tuesday through Friday. We receive it in between 8 a.m and 9:30 at the latest, if there's some sort of traffic or bump in the road. And then it goes out. We have a full-time delivery driver, and we have a fleet of volunteers that help with delivery. So Tuesday through Friday, we get our deliveries, and produce goes out same day. And then tomorrow has like add-ons for all kinds of different reasons and opportunities that the folks who are delivering will take along with them. And then Thursday we have our free market, which is set up like a farmer's market. Everything's in bulk. And the folks can like pick what they want. People are still leaving there with typically like 30 to 40 pounds of produce, staple item. We always have bread from Dos Hermanas. We've got eggs from this local egg guy that's really great. That I met him once in a parking lot. I've never like talked to him, but we're a fan. He's going to be a sweet person. He's really passionate about feeding the community. That's the really cool thing about farmers, is like they care. They're rad people. We always have meat. Not always, but like a lot of times, Rebel Meats is another long contributor to ours. They have like really fancy, delicious meat. Some of like the best quality meat that you can get in town. We have coffee, tea, like all kinds of staples that happen at market. So yeah, that's kind of how it works for us. It's different than the traditional way that people think of CSA, is they pay a farmer up front and then they get what they get when they get it. That's not how we're operating. And again, that interpretation of CSA is wrong anyways, because I've read a lot about Booker T. Wiley, and that's not what he was talking about. So we've reinterpreted our own way, and yeah, that's what we're doing. We're supporting the community with local agriculture.
If you just tuned in, this is Keeping It Real. I'm Lisa Loving, and our guest is AJ McCrary of the Equitable Giving Circle. They provide radical care for the Black and Brown community in Portland, Oregon. And I also volunteer for what's called Urban Gleaners in Portland. And so they also have free markets several times a week. I don't know if they're doing that now because it's winter. But I volunteered going out and picking stuff in the field. And the thing that I didn't realize until I did that is that farmers are visionaries. Like,
I thought farmers like a tough person, and they got wheat coming out.
No. These people are dreamers.
Yeah.
And it's a trip. And they do a lot that may or may not even come back for them. Mm-hmm. Right? They're taking chances all the time. And I met really young people who have, you know, gotten degrees at Oregon State University in different kinds of agriculture. And they're out there with different ideas about the sun and the water. It's fascinating. And we've also had on this show, we've had African-American farmers talking about their work. So when you say that when you were first thinking about Equitable Giving Circle, you thought you were going to work in the business space. This is the business space. You're like, that's an incredible interface between these are small businesses, and they're super risky too. And making sure that food goes someplace that they know it's not going to be wasted, it's going to be appreciated. That's a big deal.
Yeah, thank you. It is, I mean, at the core of our work, we do talk about the economics of it. And I do appreciate you uplifting. Yes, we're still in the business space. We're still being really intentional. We're intentional about where we spend our dollars in community. We really believe in that. You know, if it's not a Black person or a brown person, okay, are they queer owned? Are they small owned business? Is it local? We really try to like lean in that regards from an economic standpoint. Tragically, in the way of comms works, is like our larger community is still scared to talk about economy and dollars and money and economic, like it's still really money. So like we get further with people to talk about this, really focus on the direct service aspect of our work and not the ways that this is also building economics and community, because that people get real, they get funny about money.
Yeah, we do. We get funny about money. This is the United States of America, and we're funny about money.
You are.
Some people have all of it. I'm just putting that out.
Yeah, those people.
Those people, right?
We should learn about sharing.
So, I don't mean to be like a fatalist or anything, yeah. But what would happen to our communities here in Portland if you didn't do this? Because, I mean, you're even talking about child welfare. No, stop. The child welfare, infant child welfare thing, that is such a big deal. I almost just cursed because that's how big of a deal it is. And Shafia Monroe, the founder of the International Center for Midwifery, for International Midwifery, she's been talking about this issue for decades. Oregon has some of the very, very worst. This entire country has a terrible infant and child mortality rate. It's shocking as hell. I am going to curse a little bit. And so that discussion never comes up in these presidential politics and the elected officials. It's so crucial. And I understand that even this week, there's going to be some kind of talk about new regulations, new programs at the Oregon State Legislature about families of color, infant and mother mortality. But I mean, that one is such a difficult one to move the goal. Talk about that a little bit more. Like, so how did you come about doing that? How did that become folded into your work?
Well, a lot of our work is also a reflection of the experiences and firsthand knowledge our team has experienced. So we're a team of Black women from Portland. A handful of us on our team have been single mothers. Many women on our team have given birth to children. It's scary. Like, not the actual giving birth part. And everyone is different, but that's a lot. Like, the physical aspect of giving birth is a lot, but also the reality of going into a hospital in the United States is good luck. Really hope that you have a handful of people that are interface with you that really care and get it and catch it. And you know, I can speak on when I was in my early 20s, I almost died from a medication that my body wasn't metabolizing appropriately. And it was a Black nurse that looked at the chart, started flipping and was like, oh, we're poisoning you. And I was like, oh my God, like I've been thinking that I've been dying for 8 weeks and in and out of the hospital. And all these people had checked all these things. It wasn't until literally a Black woman was like, oh, I know exactly. I've seen this before. This is... And she patched me right up. And like 2 days later, I was fine and normal and no longer being poisoned. I was really headed to sepsis and would ultimately have died on something that was like really super small and shouldn't have ever happened, right? Like, yikes on bike. That happens at an even worse rate when you start inserting pregnancy and babies and that we're not listened to and that medical providers are not necessarily like culturally specifically trained or they have weird, racist, harmful, dated, dusty understandings of Black bodies and just medicine. So it's dangerous, right? And so we're talking about this as a team from first lived-hand experience of women that we know, people that we've lost in our community. And so a lot of our work is a reflection, not just of that, but also what we're hearing directly from the community, right? Like, we are in constant conversation with our community. Last year, we had 108 events over a span of a year. So those were actual times that we were in community, conversating, being face-to-face, engaging with people. We hear all kinds of things from them. Feedback, needs, stories, good, bad, ugly, update. So we're able to like take that back to how when we're talking, planning, dreaming things up, like, okay, is this what people are saying they want, they need? And more support is constantly the ask, like all the time. How can we get more support? And for specific things, right? Like our elders need some more support in our care. Our young people need more support around like job development, leadership, just mentorship. We've got young people that needs all kinds of needs. Schools, we've got babies that need more childcare options, families that need more wraparound services. We're not the only folks out here doing really good, robust work. Like we are in good company. I definitely want to like uplift that. Like we're not alone. And yeah, it's just that we need more services. And I think too, for us being able to dream stuff up from the space that we collectively as a team sit in, it is a reflection of like, okay, in those moments, how would we have wanted care, right? Like when we talk about food insecurity, none of us have ever appreciated going to a pantry or a food spot where it's expired stuff, where there's all these signups and they're rude. But coming to market, like our market, we've dreamed that up to a space that we would feel comfortable coming and that we feel honored when our elders show up, or people, you know, like it's not embarrassing, it's a joyful space. We think about the kinds of programming around getting resources out back to school, holiday extravagance, the kind of same thing. We're thinking about how we can support birthing families and families with new babies. What are the kinds of things that we needed and wanted? What are the things that will make this an easier transition or more supported? And even sometimes too, how are we signaling to these individuals, we're out here ready to support, like we care. Some of the beautiful things that have happened within some of these families we've been working with regarding brand new babies coming, being welcomed to the world, is that those families will show up to stuff and we are, oh, it's an EGC baby. And, you know, we are getting to know these folks. And this is a larger community that is excited to support and care, because we've lost a lot because of colonialization, because of white supremacy, because of capitalism, and not just Black people, not just brown people. Everybody has lost. We're all constantly losing community connection, care point, conversations, just history, knowledge, information passing, like because we're not in community conversing, building relationships, and spending time together. So yeah, that's really how that work has come about, and it is a reflection of the need and what also like a commentary of what we want to experience regularly. Like we want to see these kinds of values and norms be the norms for everybody, not just our little bubble, but like this is how we want to like walk through the world and experience, where we can care about each other, and it's a give and take that's beautiful and felt everywhere.
So I had started to ask this question a little earlier. What would happen to the communities if you did not bring this level of support? And the numbers that you're talking about, you know, Portland's communities of color are not really that big compared to other places.
Yeah.
So the numbers that you're talking about, those are really impactful numbers.
Yeah.
So what would happen if you weren't doing it?
Yeah. And for context, or for like, I appreciate you talking about the numbers. There's 80,000 Black people in Oregon. That is the last census data. We're 2.4% of the state population, so really tiny. About 36,000 Black folks in the Portland metro area. So yeah, we do have a really big footprint as a really tiny baby organization. What happened is orgs like us don't exist. We're losing really important community care and resource sharing that's helping people in real time. We will lose community connections. So something that a lot of our larger organizations, and I'll use OHSU, they come out, they're a partner, they've been coming out for over a year, I think, to market to help with health screenings and get people connected. They have some free clinics, and so we can send folks who don't have insurance support in that. And it's been really wonderful. They don't have the same access point to community as we do, right? Like I said, I have 400 household points a week that I can touch. And that's honestly, just even me as an individual, that's like just through EGC baseline work. If I was to like dig in all of that, we're probably talking about an easy 1,000 a week. And I have way, like not just me, but my team, we have additional touch points that we can share information out. I have a mutual aid group called Mom Block. There's thousands of moms in there, white, black, all kinds of colors, right? So I'm able to really push out information. My team, like we all have different sort of little pockets that we're building and organizing, and we share information and, you know, come back to and from. So the loss of support for our kind of work means a loss of a major community touch points and harming this network of work and community care that's happening. I think we'll mostly see it like the first, you know, kind of waves that comes at nonprofits. And nonprofits are a really important in-between space, both like on the ground community. Many of our Black and Brown organizations, Indigenous nonprofits, we really do work on the ground. We're not millions of dollars. Like, that's really not what's happening with Black and Brown and Indigenous you know, nonprofits. We're very close to the ground. We're connected to other orgs and groups that might not be able to fundraise, or like they don't have a nonprofit status. So the way that we can share resources with them and connect is really important, because if we're a nonprofit, we might be able to interface with the county or a large like EGC and OHSU. We're able to make that connection and then help connect resources. So the touch point could be lost. Direct services could be lost. I don't think that we collectively think about these direct services as pushing people forward or helping keep people afloat. But that is something that we do. We absolutely are making sure and helping keep families fed. We're able to connect people like just within our network, right? Like if I know there's open housing dollars, oftentimes I can be a referral to folks and like get them supported quickly. So we will lose a lot of like the, and I don't think that we're going to actually really, I live on optimism and hope. I have to as an organizer and an artist and a single mom, like it's very much part of my regular diet, is I just really have to be optimistic. I think that we're going to go through a bumpy space, but I do think there's an opportunity for us all to lean into dream and to participate in the reimagining and the building of a collective that resonates better with us. I do think it is going to be bumpy, but I believe in people, and I've had to my whole life. I believe that we're going to find ways. It's going to be work, and it is going to feel different, but I do believe we're going to be forced certain ways to share and to stretch. We practiced really well at the beginning of COVID. So the muscle is there. We're going to have to, you know, kind of warm up and lean in and start stretching and practicing. So, I mean, a lot could be lost, but I also organize with incredible people beyond just EGC, right? Black Futures Farm, Imagine Black, Black Community Portland, Black Parent Initiative, Friends of Noise, like so many places that I believe in our collective us. And so I know that it's going to be bumpy, but I believe that we will keep on keeping, and we will see the other side of this, and we have this beautiful opportunity to lean in, stretch, and grow. Yeah.
Right. If you just tuned in, this is Keeping It Real. I'm Lisa Loving. Our guest is AJ McCrary of the Equitable Giving Circle. They provide radical care for Black and Brown communities in Portland. And some of those organizations that you mentioned have been on this show.
Yeah.
And one of the things that strikes me, okay, I'm a nerd. I'm an information freak. Okay, I just have to eat it like in my breakfast cereal. I have to pour information in it. And we talk about so many of the problems of society today, and I'm not even going to list them, okay? I'm not even going to list them. When you look at them, we obsess over them, right? And they affect the politics. But when you look at almost every single one, they're affected by childhoods. You know, do these kids have food? Do they have a place to live? Do they have people who let them know how important they are? Food, shelter, wellness, and honestly, vegetables. Like, you're literally building the future for everyone. Like you said, it does affect everyone. Me, my kids, my grandpa, you know, it affects everyone. This is incredible. I'm saying this is incredible.
Yeah. Well, and we want to see more folks tap in and get excited, right? Like, we're building this out from a Black center to support the Black community. But where this potentially grows is we are able to, one, kind of shift even the conversation in food justice. Like, for example, since EGC started, you've seen a lot of people have to kind of reevaluate some of the ways that they're doing food access. And even in, like, more times, not even in a told you so moment, but as capitalism does whatever it's going to be doing, there is less opportunity to glean. And so if that's the only way that we've been building relationships and addressing food insecurity, we're not actually fixing the problem. Now we have to re-scramble and figure out a new way to adapt and to build. And so what we've been doing and will continue to do is we're trying to push and set a standard of, like, hey, we got to actually solve the problem. Got to get to the root of it. We got to go past the comfortable part, and we've got to build in consistent ways. So we're really excited to continue to be that and be an inspiration to folks, but also to get involved. Because the more that we are collectively working on this and building this out, the sooner it touches other spaces, and then the bubble gets bigger. And, like, a long-term thing that EGC is in conversation with quite a few different food justice folk, like Mudbone Grown, Feed and Freedom, Black Beavers Farm, Black Oregon Land Trust, Prismid, Black Community Portland. How do we build out a food system that take care of the 80,000 Black Oregonians and more? How are we addressing this in a way and bringing, like, what do we know from the top down and the bottom? Like, how are we meeting the middle and impacting everybody? How are we collectively building? So we're talking about and thinking about now and hoping people are picking up the vibe and why they're tapping in or mimicking us, but also really long-term thinking of, okay, how do we build this out? Not just the way it's sustainable, but it's actually a model for us to collectively move forward. When we think about the Black community of the United States, we're only about 12% of the population. And so it is very possible and realistic to be demanding not just reparations, but support and helping us build out our systems in our community. And in Oregon, we were 2.4% of the population. There's a lot of opportunity to make us whole, be a blueprint to how we then help make the rest of the Black community whole, right? As also, we have a small indigenous population here due to genocide and the colonial occupation of the United States. Here is another community that is a population that, like, we can make these people whole. Like, we can not, like, bring people back, because that's not all the way whole, but, like, we can financially move people out of poverty and so that they can thrive and move forward and uplift our own communities. So yeah, it is really important to talk about, like, from a financial state, but also just, like, a realistic state. Like, it's not as big of a problem as it's talked about. And I really like to encourage people to think about these things from a solution standpoint, from a positive. We lean into uplifting and getting excited about what's working. It also shifts the way that we're thinking about the long-term solutions and just how we feel about it and how we can participate, right? Like, if it's, oh, this impossible thing, this is such a big problem, we're going to be overwhelmed. But we talk about it as, okay, this is a really small population that we can work on making whole or that we can uplift. It really changes the way that we feel and that we can tap in.
We're starting to run out of show, but I just want to say about that, I'm always thinking about who are the best and brightest people. Who are the best and brightest people in society? Because we have them served to us and they're not, right? So there's a dictator who's taking over the country, and he's got a puppet master who's the richest man in the world. And they're going to tell you that they are the smartest people, that they are the best and brightest, but they're just the most greedy, honestly.
Yeah.
And they're the most privileged. But when you start investing in all the communities that have been left out in the United mm-hmm. States, then you're really handing fire to the best and brightest. And that's what I love about it the most. So let me ask you this. How do our listeners support you?
Yeah. A big way that folks can support is dollars. I know we give plenty about money, but dollars really do make this work go. Something I'm really honored, we have 563 reoccurring monthly donors, and I'm honored that every single one of those people, those households, have made that commitment to EGC and our community at large. We're trying to grow that commitment. Most of these donors, they donate $40 to $50 a month. So we're really trying to grow our reoccurring monthly donors and asking people to tap in. You can sign up on our website, equitablegivingcircle.org. If you got big money, send that too. Or you can write a check. The address is on the website. You can reach out as well. Our emails are all there too. If you want to volunteer, that's another really great way. And the sign up is on our website. We have a little application. It's really just so you can like come into our space being thoughtful and really reflective. And then we do a monthly volunteer orientation. It happens the second Saturday of every month. So after you've done the application, we'll invite you to that. It's pretty consistent. So if you can't go 1 month, we'll be there the next month. So you do that, and then we'll get you a background check, and we'll get you dialed in. We use a portal, so the opportunities to volunteer are pretty clear. We like to get to know our volunteers and to build a relationship and consistency with them. It might be once a week, like Mr. John. It might be a big event like Jesse, right? So their consistency looks like a lot of things. So money, volunteering. If you have connections to in-kind donations, right? Like if you are work at a food purveyor of some kind, or maybe you work at a company that makes jeans, like, and you could get us product for one of our events, hit us up. We would love to chat. We have all kinds of great in-kind donation relationships, like Bombas Socks and supporting us for years. Heart Coffee's been supporting us for years. Penzi's Spice supporting us for years. Lots of great people who they are able to offer support in that way. So that's another way that folks can tap in. All of our information is really easy to find on our website. EquitableGivingCircle.org, and also find us on social media. We're pretty fast on Instagram.
You're very Instagram. Your stuff is so, again, you're so professional. And I wish I could make graphics like that. So when it comes to volunteering and contributing and sharing, anyone from any race or background can do that, right?
Yep.
So what about people who just came here, or people who people of color who want to also tap into what you've got going? Like, if who can do that, and how do they do it?
Yeah, like if people need service, our food programming that's open right now is the market. So that happens every Thursday. It's probably not going to happen on the 13th because of the weather. But every Thursday we're there. It's just a walk up. We don't take any personal information or show any ideas of any kind. We're not interested in that. It's just very strange behavior to us. What will we do with it? So that's one way. We have community events. We will put those on our website. They're on our social medias. Like we said, Instagram is our preferred, our main, but we're also on Blue Sky. We pretend to be on TikTok. We occasionally post on LinkedIn. So you can find us, you know, on socials. And it's really just Equity Giving Circle. We should pop right up everywhere. Come to our event. As we have program that's open, we let people know. Signing up for our newsletter is another really great way to kind of dial in, because we announce stuff. We're pretty consistent. Every single month we send out a newsletter. Right now we're actually doing a Black History Month newsletter series, talking about, the first one was about Black Oregon history. The second one will be about kind of building systems. And then the other two will be about EGC, and then also just some commentary how we collectively move forward. So our newsletter is another source to tap in and also find out when we have new programming. Also, just reach out. We, all of us, try. Tomorrow's the best in her email, so she's the best. Lillian and I, we make sure like twice a week to get in our emails and really catch up and make sure we respond. So also just reach out. If we can't support, we try to forward folks to other places we know might be exactly what they're looking for. So yeah, just reach out.
All right. And that's it for our show. This is Keeping It Real with Lisa Loving. And I just want to thank you again for being here.
Yeah, thank you. This is great.
Our guest has been A.J. McCrary of the Equitable Giving Circle. They provide radical care for the Black and Brown communities in Portland. You can find out more about them online at equitablegivingcircle.org. You're listening to Keeping It Real on KBOO Portland. Make a contribution to support programming like this at kbu.fm/give or text KBOO to this number, 44321. Special thanks to the entire KBOO staff for making this all possible. Get involved by emailing volunteer@kbu.fm. Thanks for listening and stay tuned.
Tuned in to KBOO Portland, 90.7 on your FM dial.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public.